Okay, I will call the meeting to order, and we're going to start with the proclamation, which I assume Jerry Huber is going to read. No, this is a planning meeting. We don't do that. We don't need conflict early in the meeting, Mr. Manninger.
People are disturbing me here. Okay. Whereas staff who work in a human services department in family court of the county literally touch thousands of lives every day who are in need of temporary or longer-term assistance to meet their basic needs or to adjust to transitions in their families. And whereas citizens who rely upon county human services and family court programs range in age from pre-birth to over 100 years of age. And whereas county human services programs are designed to protect our most vulnerable populations, which include children, adults, children with disabilities, the aging, and people dealing with mental illness. And whereas family court mediation and family court services strive to maintain the dignity, safety, and security of families going through difficult transitions. Whereas the individuals in the entire community benefit from the investment in lives that human services and family court professionals make every day. And now, therefore, be it resolved that the La Crosse County Board does hereby proclaim the month of March 2009 as Human Services and Family Court Month and urges all citizens to join in recognizing the valuable contributions of Human Services and Family Court staff.
Moved by Jill Billing, seconded by Bev Mock. Any discussion on that? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Carried unanimously. Before we go on to the County Administrator Report, there's one item that I wanted to mention, and that is at our last county board meeting, things got a little contentious at one point, and you know, as the chair, I try to keep things collegial and try to keep everybody in harmony and so forth. And you know, Mr. Ebert had raised the issue about maybe we're going towards socialism, and Mr. Manninger gave this impassioned response. So I decided that I needed to do a little research on that topic. And well, Mr. Ebert, I have bad news for you. We are all socialists now. And Newsweek magazine did not list you as an exception in this article, by the way, so guess you got to live with it. Fair and balanced. All right. Mr. O'Malley is out in Washington, D.C. at the NACO conference, and he gave a written report, which was in your mailing. The main thing I want to remind you about with regard to that is the annual evaluation. If you happen to bring that with you tonight haven't filled it out yet, if you can fill it out while we're meeting, drop it off to me before you leave. That will help you not forget it. If you didn't bring it with you tonight or you don't have a chance to fill it out, try to get it to the chair's office as soon as possible. That annual evaluation is real important. I think, actually, Jerry, do you have anything? Or Gary,
it was in
either
the packet.
Of you? In the packet?
Yep.
Gary, anything? Okay. Anybody have any questions on the items that were in the packet? Okay. That gets us next to the Lake Neshonnic Report by Jim Light. Thank you for joining us, Jim.
Where do you want to go? Here?
Right there is good.
Okay. Well, because I have two board of supervisors on my board and another one, Mr. Ebert, that has an interest in our district because it's part of West Salem, we thought that it would be a good idea for every once in a while for me or somebody from the Lake District to come down as a sister unit of government and just kind of talk to the county and bring them up to speed on what we've been doing and what we're planning on doing. And one thing that we're kind of excited about is I have on my hand here, I was going to do a PowerPoint, but I was ill, so my voice is, if I lose my voice, I really have to apologize. I'm having a hard time struggling with this cold. But this is actually, the dark blue areas on here are where we dredged. They're the channels, they're the fish habitat, they're the areas that the $2.3 million dredge project took 1.1 million cubic yards of sediment out of Lake Neshonnic. This is the La Crosse River over here, and this is the South Shore area. This is the county park. This is Shorewood. This is the north area. One of the nice things about this is where we actually were able to put some depth in. The fishery is really starting to come back now. That's one thing on a lake that was written off in 1968 by the DNR. We can all take a lot of solace in the fact that the fishery and the resource has really bounced back with a lot of effort over the last 23, 24 years by a lot of our volunteers. And this dredge project that La Crosse County partnered with us on in the state of Wisconsin, this kind of gives you a little bit of a graphic of where your $1 million went. We recently have put a handicap pier working with the NASA Squirrel Group right at the east end of the county park. We just built 14 fish cribs to the tune of about $1,000 at the end of January, which went in this area and over here. And that's to hopefully give the game fish a little bit of protection and the smaller fish a place to go. There's no, as you can see, it looks like a bathtub other than where the holes and the channels are. So we recently completed that. The DNR does fish studies on a yearly basis. They think that the fish population are a little bit worried about the walleyes, but the crappies and the northern and the bass are doing very well. They put a bunch of muskies in, and they're going to stock again some muskies in the lake. That was a little bit of a problem with a lot of people that are game fishermen, but we had to kind of default to the experts and the biologists and you know, hope that they knew what they were doing. The Lake District itself, we have about a $341,000 annual budget. We're looking at doing a major shoreline renovation in this area where the Village of West Salem purchased some land, and because the village is basically comprises the majority of the Lake District, we decided that we'd partner with them. We want to get in and do some shoreline dredging, get some depth there so people could actually walk down and fish and enjoy that 11-acre park. So we're kind of excited. We're going to be putting that out for bid hopefully next month. So that will also help us spread some of the sediment on the area, in the park area, to smooth it out, and they can use it for some soccer fields and some green space. So that's probably going to eat up the majority of our budget, I think. We do have a small tax, special tax, that we get every year that brings in about $38,000. It's only a half mil it's an eighth mil. When we did the dredge project to pay for our part of our bonding, it was at a half mil. So there, you know, we're still seeing a lot of support from the people in West Salem. We're more like a fire district now than because we don't have the big major projects that we have ongoing. We do have some concerns with La Crosse County that we addressed in July, and Steve and everybody, I think it was a good idea for us to get together last year. And there's some erosion problems. Is 50% of the land is basically county land. We really would like you to target some areas like Lewis's Point that is eroding into the lake very badly. Shoreline stabilization, rip wrapping, whatever. I know it's expensive, but it really needs to be done because all of the efforts that we put into dredging the lake, we just don't want it to continue to fill in. There are some areas in Swarthout Park where quite a few trees are now falling into the lake, which is due to shoreline erosion. And so we asked Jim Spropolis and his group to take a look at that, maybe do some funding for some projects to try to do some shoreline stabilization. We'll continue to do our part that we can. We also, because of the dredging, we've been donating some money to the West Salem Fire Department. We donated about $3,400 for an inflatable boat and for a motor for that boat so that they can actually get out in the summer and use that if they have to do rescues. It's available to them on their trucks, but it's also the type that you can do ice rescues. When you build it and they come, you have to make sure that you can get out there if somebody does go in, and the safety aspect is really important. So we've been kind of partnering with them on some fairly nice projects that we're pretty happy the way that they've responded. So all in all, as far as the state of the lake, I think it's doing really good. I think that we have to stay vigilant. The main problem that we see right now is the common carp. We've had a resurgence in carp. There is only one fisherman that has the rights to fish the lake as far as a commercial fisherman, and we have tried to pay more money. We've tried everything we could over the last 3-4 years to get somebody to come in there and actually pull the carp, because that's going to just improve the fishery. Going to continue to do it. We can't force them. The DNR can't force them to come in. But that's really, if I had to identify one major problem with the lake, it's the carp are starting to come back. And fortunately, we're not like Lake Toma, where we're talking about poisoning the lake or anything. So I think that, you know, between the Lake District and the county and a lot of the cooperation we're seeing from the Department of Natural Resources, a lot of people say, hey, this is a really good success story, because, you know, over the years since 1968, it was a lot of volunteer efforts and a lot of recognition by a lot of governmental groups that Lake Neshonoc is a very important resource to this area, being the only inland lake, and we're just happy that we can still continue to make it a good resource. So I would entertain any questions if anybody had any.
Jim, what's the latest projection on when the next dredging would be needed? Any guess?
Well, I get that question a lot. You know,
sure you do.
I've been the Lake District Chairman for 23 years, and I don't know if I have enough energy to do another dredge project. We're continuing to bank a little money for that. It's difficult, and you know, in budgetary times, this area that is the sediment trap. I mean, there's probably some plans in the future to get in there with a smaller dredge and maybe take care of that. But you know, who knows when somebody like La Crosse County and even the Lake District is going to be able to come up with another couple million dollars to dredge it. You know, one nice thing for the county is, as far as their participation in that project, is there's a stormwater retention pond that we use for our runoff that you're able to use for the build out of the industrial park, and so that was a real nice byproduct of your involvement too. So,
Jeff Schrader.
I'll forego because you asked the exact question I was going to. Thanks.
Okay, Jim Burns.
Thank you. Jim, thank you for that report. Quick question. You mentioned the property around the lake is owned by, of course, many private and public entities. And I guess my question is this, regarding the jurisdiction of the Lake District. Where does your jurisdiction start and end? I guess you mentioned partnering with the city of, or the village of West Salem, possibly with the county of La Crosse. I guess maybe you could just kind of explain your jurisdiction or your role in the context of La Crosse County and the village of West Salem and other private entities that own property around the lake.
Yeah, good question, because there's so many people, because we have what we call the Friends of Lake Neshonoc, which is basically our fundraising arm. And they put on dinners and do the ice fishing derby and things like that. So a lot of people think we're a club, and we're not. We're actually State Charter 33, Chapter 33, Chartered Lake Districts. It was basically so that people living around lakes, that as state funds kind of dried up, it gave them the ability to raise taxes through a special tax assessment if 51% of the landowners in that district agreed to form a district. And that was a 2-year battle for us. As far as jurisdiction goes, we're basically the stewards. I think that we look at ourselves as the people that have the most inherent knowledge of some of the problems that are going on there. Because we're a lake district, we can apply for lake management planning grants, which we did to basically, you know, get the dredge project undertaken. We don't have any regulatory authority. We can make recommendations. We've defaulted to the county as far as sponsoring like car races or snowmobile races or things like that, because, you know, we're all non-paid. We're just all volunteers. And so it's basically, you know, we're there to facilitate and to work with a lot of different groups, so try to put together partnerships. But really, we're basically the stewards of the lake, I think, as far as, you know. And the only thing the state did is it gave us the ability to raise some funds through taxation, which is really the only thing that we can do. DNR controls all the regulations, and La Crosse County owns the lake bed and 50% of the shoreline. So,
Don Vina.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess, you know, if you've been reading the paper, you've been watching Lake Toma, and they're going to drain that lake and do what we would have probably had to do in Lake Neshonnik if we wouldn't have got the carp out over the years gone by, because fishing isn't much of anything anymore. But in addition to what Jim was talking about, you know, years ago, I've been on land conservation for 20 years, and we went through the whole county about 18 years ago, and we prioritized all our water and our streams, and Dutch Creek was one of them. That was the sedimentation going into the lake up around Bangor and then down through to the lake was not very good. And we took our county money and we stuck it in that that whole watershed, and it's now in pretty good shape. There's not a lot of sedimentation coming out of Dutch Creek anymore. And if you know, in the last few years, we went up through Burns the other way, and that also drains into the lake. We haven't got all the problems solved there yet, but we're working on them. And so that all helps the sedimentation in the lake, and that's hopefully that that hole we dug on the northern part will be the sediment trap, and we'll, most of the sedimentation would go in there, and all we have to do in years to come is to dig that out and clean it out and deepen it, and it's good for another X number of years.
As part of the prelude to doing the dredging, we did a survey, and we for years we worked on how much sedimentation was coming into the lake on a yearly basis. And after a grad study did an analysis of it, it was between 10 and 12,000 cubic yards of sediment entering the lake every year. Now, that was prior to the early 80s, and you know, farming has changed, and you know, some of the conservation practices have changed. And so when we took a look at that that sediment trap, we said, hey, if we can get a 500,000 cubic yards of sediment out at the mouth of the river, and then theoretically the heavy sediments, the sand and the heavy sediment that's coming in, if it can drop off, and we want it to drop off into that hole by changing how the flow of the water is, we said, hey, if there's 10,000 cubic yards coming in and we take a 500,000 cubic yards out, we can hopefully save the lake for another 50 years before somebody has to do anything. And that's kind of how we went to the county and we went to our taxpayers to kind of, you know, talk about, you know, the program. I will say one thing. You probably read that with regarding to the selling of the sand out of the disposal area. Our board and a lot of the people in the village really feel that because the Lake District kind of took the lead and worked with the state to get $300,000 in recreational boating funds, and we bonded our taxpayers for $1 million to do our part of the dredge project. I went to the old Parks and Property Committee with a baggie of sand and said, hey, this thing has some value, and maybe we can both partner and you know, maybe we can sell sand. And you know, I didn't go there with any real idea of what it was worth or anything. And then it wasn't too much longer after that Walmart was going to build out in Onalaska, and La Crosse County sold some sand out of there. And you know, I guess we just felt, and we still feel, and we're probably still going to put through a resolution that if in the future, and I don't know if there will ever be any future selling of the sand, but the Lake District, because we paid for over half of it, you know, we'd like to get half of the resources from that. And the selling of the property on the lake, I know that, thank goodness, it was the way that the resolution was written, any of the revenue from me, I was part of that, having to buy our lake frontage, but we were very happy to see that at least that was earmarked, and the earmarking, I know, isn't a good term anymore, but we were happy to see that was going to be earmarked for projects to help Lake Neshonnik and not go elsewhere, because that property is on the lake, So, you know, we just we don't know what's going on with that, but I'm sure we'll be informed when, if and when that's sold. I did want to say one other thing, and I don't want to take up all your time, but I have to really applaud the county for the boat landings. The way that the boat landings have turned out with the new docks, a lot of guys that were able to pull their boats out at the end of the year, including myself, really appreciate just how well that was engineered, and that was just a great project, and it really needed to be done, because as everybody's loading their boats by driving them on, you get these big holes out there, and that was on both of the boat landings. They turned out great, and I really applaud the county for doing that. Jim and his group did a good job on that.
Other questions or comments? Okay, Jim, thank you very much.
Thank you. I took more than 10 minutes, didn't I?
That was fine.
Okay, thank you.
All right, next on the agenda, it says report on OWI court by Jim Zollweg. Well, we have his identical brother, Bill Zollweg, who is actually the real name. Bill's going to do a report on OWI court.
Good evening. I'm Dr. Bill Zollweg, and I did the federal evaluation for La Crosse's OWI court program. First part of this will be a little bit of the demographics about the type of people that are participating in the program. Here's the age distribution for people in the program, and you can see it's a pretty wide range from 21 to over 61. The majority of people are over age 35, and you can see between 35 or 36 and 50 is the bulk of all of the participants. The average age of this group of participants is 39 years old. So we're not talking about young kids out drinking and driving. These are serious repeat offenders that have at least two, and those you'll primarily find at the low end down here of the 21 to 30 year olds, and to be in with a second offense into La Crosse's program, they have to be assessed by an AOD counselor as being chemically dependent. Otherwise, three and up, they're automatically in, but when we get to five, then it's the district attorney's office that recommends the person for the program or not. In terms of race of the participants, in the first year of the program, about 13% were non-white, but in the second year, it dropped to 11% non-white. We have an average there of about 12%. The statewide average for repeat offenders is about 4%, nationally about 5%, and our non-white population for La Crosse is less than 2%. So you can see we have a large number of minorities, and I'm not really sure what that says about what's happening in La Crosse. But I like to caution people that this is not a random sample of the people arrested. This is the people who volunteered to be in the program. So it's not necessarily some kind of indictment against the police department in La Crosse. It could be, and it may well be, that non-white repeat offenders are more likely to take advantage of the opportunity to have a strong, stern program that helps them stop drinking. Sex of the offenders, about 19% overall is female, and that follows pretty closely to the state's average for repeat offenders. About 21% of the repeat offenders in the state of Wisconsin are female, so we're right in line in terms of women in the program. So there's not a higher inclination on the part of women to join the program than there are men, but there does seem to be for minorities. This chart shows you the status of the participants. The light bar on the left side is the first year, and the darker bar is the second year of operation. We've had a total of 122 graduates from the program, and the average length of time it takes to make it through the program, it's a minimum of 1 year program, 1 year of total sobriety. But the average is 15 months, so it's significantly longer than the one-year average it takes them, and that's because they have a tendency to relapse. If you know anyone who's tried to quit drinking, it's really considered, in modern treatment terms, a part of the program that you will have a relapse. And it's that relapse that takes them a little bit longer. We've had 154 in the 2 years who have either been expelled from the program for non-compliance with program conditions. Sometimes this is behavioral, and other times it's just they keep relapsing over and over and over again, and they're not really making it through the program.
What is your graduation rate?
The graduation rate is about 56%. I'll get to that in a few minutes. 90 have been expelled and 64 have voluntarily dropped out. It is actually a voluntary program, even though we consider it to be a coercive treatment program. It's a voluntary program, so at any time they can say, I'd rather take the jail sentence or whatever sentence has been handed down for that particular offender. And some of them do, because quite frankly, this is a very difficult program to make it through. It's 1 year of just about everything in your life being supervised by a judge or justice sanctions or some other court administrator. If you're not familiar with the program, it's a three-phase program. The first phase, they are supervised extremely closely. They're drug tested and alcohol tested at least 3 to 5 times a week. Some, and many I would say, are tested every day and sometimes more than once a day, depending upon the severity of their alcohol problem. They have to receive treatment, they have to be in support groups, they have to meet with their caseworker on a weekly basis, they have to appear before the judge on a weekly basis. Then in phase two, the reins lighten up a little bit and we give them a little bit more leeway. They're tested a little bit less, and then in phase three it's even more. And phase three is the longest program, the longest part of the program, the phase of the program, and that's because it's the point where we're about to release them from supervision back into the public, and we want to make sure that they can on their own maintain their sobriety without that strong supervision from the program. One of the things that's important for all of these types of program, whether it's a drug court or the OWI court program, is we'd like to get them into the program as soon after their arrest as possible. That's easier said than done, and it's one of the things that I know the La Crosse OWI treatment court program works on a monthly basis, trying to speed up the time. What we know from research is that the person is at their weakest point the day they're arrested. So the sooner we can get them into the program, the more willing they are to participate and be compliant with the behavioral requirements of the program. So the longer it takes, the more difficult it is to help that person make it through the program in the shortest amount of time. So you see our short time is 8/10 of a month, and our long time is 10 months. We have an average of 3.5 months to make it in the program. With some individuals, it's not possible to make it shorter. They have pending sentences for other offenses, so they have to clear up that jail time before they're actually eligible to be let into the OWI program. So we can only do so much in terms of shortening that, but the goal is to make it as short as possible. And we'd like less than 3.5 months. Many of the participants are randomly drug tested while they're in the program. Although most of the participants do not have other drug problems, by far and away the majority of people have alcohol only as their drug of dependence. Many of them do have secondary drug dependencies. So those people are tested, and you can see in the first year of the program, about 1,116 urinalysis tests were done using the light spectrometer machine from Justice Sanctions. Of those, 416 of those urine samples tested positive for one drug, at least one drug. You see that 1,500 number there, and basically that's the number of urine specimens that were used for testing, and generally the tests are done probably on five drugs. So if you really multiply that number times five, that's how many drug tests were done. And you see it stayed the same in the next year. 27% of the people that were sampled, that were selected for random sample urinalysis, tested positive. What happens here is that they know for sure in the program that they're going to be tested on a regular basis for alcohol. So in order to try and satisfy their need for an altered state of consciousness, they turn to some other drug, thinking that they're going to be able to get by the breath test. So they feel like they're being very clever, and my suspicions are that these numbers will decrease as the program goes on, because the word will get out that you can't get by the spectrometer machine. In terms of alcohol tests, there were 82,383 alcohol tests administered to participants in the first 2 years of the program. If you look at the bars on the next side there, I don't have a pointer here, so I can't... Oh, here I do, yeah. You see the first bar here tells you the number of missed drug tests. The second bar is the number of missed alcohol tests. They missed 2,240 alcohol tests. That is, they didn't respond to their sobrieter, which is at home, a machine that they have to blow into, or they didn't show up for their breathalyzer at Justice Sanctions. In the program, a missed test is counted as a positive test. So they get out of nothing by missing a test. It's considered a positive result. And they receive the same kind of sanctions that they would if they had blown in and tested positive for alcohol. Some of the other drugs, and I'd like to mention this one here, the one right here next to it, flushing it's called. 223 tested positive for flushing. The light spectrometer machine that's used by the Justice Sanctions Office can tell if somebody has tried to tamper with their urine at all. And you can buy a number of different chemical kits that'll promise you that, if you just take this goldenrod and something else, and then your urine will be clean. And, of course, basically what it boils down to is you drink a gallon or so of water before you go in for the test, and what you've done is dilute your urine to the point where none of the other drugs that are in there can be tested. But the light spectrometer machine picks up on that and tells us when somebody has tried to tamper with their urine. So those tests are also considered positive. What we have then is basically the 434 positive alcohol tests and the 2,240 missed tests, and what that gets down to is less than 3% of the participants test positive for alcohol while they're going through the program. So we have more a higher percentage of drug, although not everyone in the program is tested for drugs, but we have a higher percentage of those that have used drugs in the past that test positive for drugs than we do those that are dependent on alcohol, test positive for alcohol.
What are the consequences?
The drug court uses, the OWI court uses a graduated sanctions protocol, which basically says that the first offense we're going to try and, although we tailor each sanction to the particular offender. So some people who have like a long history of being in jail, incarcerated for one thing or another, jail is not a punishment that is going to have any effect on their behavior. They've already demonstrated that to us in the past. So they'll get some other kind of sanction, maybe a community service or sometimes write and deliver an essay to the judge or in front of the crowd, which is terrifying to many of the participants. They'll get some other sanction. The idea, though, is that we want to administer the lowest possible sanction to produce the behavioral change that we desire. Research tells us over and over again that when you use the lowest possible sanction, that change in behavior lasts longer than when you come down with a heavy hand to change behavior. As soon as that heavy hand is not a threat anymore, the person goes right back to committing the behavior again. And I won't ask you all, but usually when I do this part right here, I ask people how many people have had a ticket for speeding, and pretty much everybody in the room raises their hand, and then I ask how many people speed, and pretty much everyone in the room raises their hand, and that's because even though it's a very heavy fine, it's not in a way to change your behavior. It's not designed in a way to change your behavior. And so we'll fine you $168, I think is the average for a ticket, speeding ticket in the state of Wisconsin. And, you know, for a week, people are pretty good. And then they go right back to their same behavioral pattern. So that sentence, that sanction is not designed to change people's behavior. The lowest possible sanction that we can use is the way to go. So we start with the lowest possible one, and then we'll step it up until the behavior changes. So we just keep graduating our sanctions until we get the desired behavior.
Done.
Mr. Chair, are these just people in the OWI?
Yes.
The
not in there. Just OWI. Here is a look at the graduates, the 122 graduates of the program. And here's what their experience was for the first 122 that graduated. They were tested an average of 317 times in phase one of the program, 163 times in phase two of the program, 87 times in phase three of the program. So they participated in an average of 567 drug tests. So just to give you an idea, for those 122 who graduate, that's 69,000 tests. They tested positive four times, and they missed four tests. Yes?
Could those four be the same number? You said a miss is a positive.
Yes. That would be eight times positive.
Eight.
Right, and that goes into the figure of for the 122 graduates, their positive rate of alcohol tests was 1.4%. One of the side benefits of the program, and one of the aspects of all OWI treatment programs that are run in accordance with the guidelines of the Department of Justice, is something that is so important for the community to understand, and I think it's has very little understanding for the community in terms of what the criminal justice system does and why we have such a high rate of recidivism in this country from people who serve time in jail or prison. And that is, being in jail or being in prison literally destroys the family support group. It segregates people for such a long time from their family that once they get out, they really lack that family support that keeps them from repeating the behavior that got them in jail in the first part. So nationally, we have between 65 and 75% of all the people we put in jail in this country go back out within 2 years and commit the same offense or a higher level offense. That's the experience with jail we have in this country. What the OWI court program does that's a little bit different is it keeps people in the community so that they have an opportunity to make reunification with their family. And this chart here shows that of the graduates, 48 of them were reunified with their family. This is siblings, brothers and sisters, aunts and uncles who have cut them off and said, we don't want you around anymore. And I think a lot of people have experience with this, where, you know, you just as soon, you know, relative X, Uncle Bill didn't show up to the family reunion because he's always drunk and it just destroys everybody's good time. And these are people who've been completely cut off from their family and are now reunified with their family. We've had 10 who've been reunified with their parents. Their parents have cut them off. 14 have been reunified, regained custody of their children. And 4 have been reunified and now have visitation with their grandchildren. And now these are the sons and daughters who have said, you know, Grandpa Bill, we don't want you coming around no more, and we're not going to let you spend time with the kids because you're always drunk. One of the sanctions that is used in the OWI program is, first let me tell you about the employment status. We have virtually full employment. 93% of the graduates were employed. It's a requirement of the program that you, if you're not employed when you're in the program, you have to be employed to leave the program. So employment is a requirement. We have five people who were not employed, or actually it's really 4 that we can be sure of. One we kind of have lost track of, but 4 that were not employed, and those are all for reasons of disability. So while we require them to have a job, if there's a legitimate reason for not being able to have a job, we understand that, and many of them do have disabilities that make it impossible. Yes, yes, they are. And the majority of them are employed at the time of their arrest. One of the sanctions that's used for missed test, most likely a missed test, is the first sanction that's relied on is community service. The graduates performed about 700 hours of community service. The county bills that out at $10 an hour. And that's about $7,000 a year in community service benefit that the graduates performed while they're going through the OWI program. Now let's talk, now that we've gotten through the basics, let's talk about actual outcome and has this program done any good. I went to the Department of Transportation and got the records on convictions for the 2 years prior to La Crosse starting its OWI program. So that's 2004 and 2005. La Crosse started the program in 2006, so I compared the 2004, 2005, 2006, and 2007, the pre and the post years of the program. Reduced the number of second offenses by 24%. Reduced the number of third offenses by 22%. Reduced the number of fourth offenses by 10%. Reduced the number of fifth or more offenses by 38%. That's an average, overall, 24% reduction in the number of OWIs in La Crosse County. Normally, this is where people stand and cheer.
So I'll just
wait.
Crowd.
I'll wait for that. Well, the first thing you ask is, how does that compare? And, you know, when I saw the number, I'll tell you, quite frankly, I said, well, you know, 2004, 2005, those were pretty good years for the economy. Things were not too bad. 2006, 2007, that's when we had, you know, almost $4 a gallon gas, so people just weren't driving. They just went to their local taverns. That's what they're doing. They're just not drinking and driving. They can't afford to drink and drive. They can't afford to do both. Put gas in the car and drink. So they picked drinking instead of putting gas in the car. So the reasonable thing to do is compare it to other places that are similar to La Crosse. So I used the Cary reports comparison counties, which were used for the criminal justice evaluation in La Crosse, and looked what happened to those counties. And here's the same thing. It's the checkered one on the left is the pre-La Crosse, and the solid one on the right is post. And what you have is Eau Claire went up 2%, 2% more OWIs. Marathon County went down 1%. Sheboygan went down 4%. Winnebago went down 8%. And then here is La Crosse. We went down 24%. The statewide average, by the way, was a 4% decrease overall for the state. 4%. Sure. You know, they could get tickets in Minnesota or Iowa, and that is not part of, right.
Good question.
Yep, and that's absolutely true. They could. So if they stay over there, I guess it's not our problem, though, right?
Actually, don't those states report to our DOT for?
It wouldn't be on this. Wouldn't be on this. It would be on an individual record. We could find out.
I think the purposes of renewing your license.
Yes, and the next chart will check into whether or not we know on an individual level. This chart doesn't really do that.
Jim Burns.
Thank you. Bill, you mentioned the. You referenced the decision that people make whether they. Go out and drink, or whether they put gas in the car. Are you the inference there then is that most of the individuals in this OWI court are lower social economic status? Is that
yes?
Okay. Like, do you have some numbers that go through
in terms of their income?
Yeah.
No, I don't.
Okay. Thank you.
No. 122 graduates to date. Of those 122, we have not at the end of this report, which was December of last year, but since we've had one repeat the offense. And that is really good news, but this is where you should not stand and applaud. Because, you know, here's the reality of drunk driving. And again, I think this gets lost on the public because I think the public's conception of your drunk driver is that they drive drunk and then they get the ticket and then they get themselves out of jail and then they go over to the bar and they drink and then they drive drunk and then they get the ticket and then they're back in there and they just keep doing this over and over again. Now, this chart shows you the number of years for the graduates between their offenses. Now, with 122, there's a large number of offenses. So, but you can see it goes from within 1 year between offenses to 11 years between offenses. The average here for our graduates is 3.5 years. So, in order for us to really collect meaningful recidivism data on this group of graduates, I think it's going to take over 3 years for us to be able to say, has the program reduced recidivism? And that's the nature of repeat offending. And there really isn't much we can do about that. We can't speed that up at all. Yeah?
I might have missed something.
No, well, some of them are on probation, so they're still connected to the criminal justice system in some cases, especially fourth and fifth offenders would be, still being tested, at least occasionally, by probation parole. But the others are not. They have spent their year clean, and now they're back. And Actually, at the end, I'll try to get to, you know, where I think it's going for that.
Couple of questions that I may have missed. What percentage of the people eligible for the OWI court are actually in it? Are you able to serve everyone who says, I'd like to be in it, or who the judge would want to order into it?
We are able to serve everyone who wants in it.
Okay.
There's no question about that. In terms of the percentage, though, it's a small percent that doesn't accept the program.
24 people out of 165 do not participate.
24 out of 165
okay.
In this past year.
In what percentage of the population who you think are actually driving while under the influence would that be? Do you think
I'm not sure I understand the question. You mean out of everybody who drinks and drives, or out of everybody who is a repeat offender?
Well, people sometimes will lie to their drug counselors and not admit to the severity of their alcohol problem. So I'm wondering.
Oh, I see.
If there are more people who should, well, they're not going to be in the program unless they're arrested, of course.
Well, if they're a third offender, they're in. We don't need an AOD assessment for that. It's only the second offenses that require the AOD assessment of dependent to be admitted to the program.
Okay. So maybe more people.
There might be more
seconds. Okay.
Yes. Anything above that is automatically eligible for the program. We just assume that they have a dependency problem.
Okay.
You see?
Okay.
So it's it's all of the thirds and above are eligible.
Okay. And then when you talk about the 24% reduction, that's and I might have missed this also, that's among the people in the program, or
no,
that's everyone.
That's everyone.
Okay. I want to clarify that. Okay.
That's everyone. No. It's everyone. Yeah. And those are convictions, not arrests.
Bill, can
the number for arrests, I believe the La Crosse Tribune reporter did a pretty good job of looking up the arrest record, and it's even more significant than convictions.
Bill, can you correlate this chart with the earlier ones? If we really don't expect these people to be getting rearrested yet anyway, how do we explain the 24% decrease? I mean, is this word getting out, don't get arrested, or don't
get
driving across?
Well, we've taken 300 people, and they're being supervised continuously, so that's a huge
right,
group
but most
right there.
Of those wouldn't, under this chart, most of them wouldn't have been arrested anyway during this time.
No, but if they're out of the driving pool in this program.
Sure.
Without this program, they would be back in the driving pool, and many of them would be driving without a license. I mean, driving without revocation is very, very, very common. So,
Don?
Bill, of the 122, are charges dropped then once they graduate, or what's the status there? You said some are on probation or something, but drug court, they drop the charges.
You can't drop an OWI conviction, so they're convicted. What happens is their sentence, their normal judicial sentence is stayed. So they still have to pay fines, they still have penalties, everything else is the same, it's just the jail that's really taken away.
Okay. Ann?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you follow them after the year and after they've gotten out to know if they even live in the county anymore?
Yes. Yes, these 122 will be tracked now to make sure of what our recidivism is, and future graduates as well.
I just didn't know if they could move out of state then.
Well, they could, and, you know, I mean, it's not possible to keep track of everyone. I can't guarantee that we'll be able to keep track of everyone. But everyone that we can will be kept track of.
Ralph?
percentage is going down for this and that, but aren't there other factors at play here? Isn't La Crosse County big into safe ride? Most people taking the safe ride do not want to be pulled over. That's why they're taking the safe ride, obviously.
Yeah.
You got education, the schools.
Oh, yes, absolutely. All those factors.
If you drive drunk, you're going to get pulled over, and et cetera.
Yes, I think community awareness is, and one other thing that you didn't mention that I think has had a big effect is the ordinance on public drunkenness. Right. I think all of those things, absolutely. But none of those things could help rehabilitate someone who's dependent on alcohol.
Right. My point was the entire percentage drop maybe was enhanced by other factors.
Absolutely.
Other than the program.
Absolutely. I agree completely. Yes.
Joe?
Thank you. Maybe somebody in here knows this, but I think there's a move to make thirds a felony, and it might even be in the budget, if I'm not mistaken. So I'm curious about if you know, or perhaps Ms. Kleekamp knows, what sort of implications that will have as far as the justice sanctions OWI court budget and the impact on us.
Well, I don't know. I'll let Jane speak for herself, but I don't know that it's going to have any implications for the budget of the OWI program. But I can tell you, if you think the state of Wisconsin is in debt now, wait till third offenses are a felony. You know, what's happening is we're putting the cart before the horse here. We're increasing the penalty. Without these types of programs that allow people to recover from their dependency, if you're just going to put them in jail, then we're going to have a repeat of what we had here for the past 50 years in the state of Wisconsin, of people getting out of jail and going out and getting drunk and driving again. There's no rehabilitation. There's no treatment. There's no opportunity for recovery. So without these programs in place ahead of time, I'm all for third offense is a felony. Most of our neighboring states have that already. But I'm not for having third offense as a felony without programs like this that offer an opportunity for rehabilitation ahead of time.
Brad.
But obviously, I mean, you've been following this issue. This is a serious issue, not just in La Crosse County, but in the state of Wisconsin. I mean, any person that reads the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, even on an occasional basis, recognizes the fact that the state of Wisconsin is having a serious public policy debate about what we're going to do with drunk driving. There is in the budget, rightfully or wrongfully, a move to have the third offense be a felony. I guess the question I have for you is, if this works, and it appears that it does work, why aren't our state policy makers talking about this?
Well, I think there is some talk of this, but, you know, La Crosse is really the only pilot program in the state. Two other counties, Washington County and Waukesha County, have alternative to court programs. But they're not modeled on the Department of Justice guidelines like La Crosse is. And so La Crosse is the only one that is has a federal evaluator to, and part of my job is to make sure that the program follows the guidelines from the Department of Justice.
To me, and I'll wrap up, because I think that your presentation has been excellent, and I support this program, but I would not just speak in a vacuum here. You have an opportunity here in the next few months. State legislature is putting together its budget when they're looking for all good ideas and suggestions to take this forward and to work with Steve O'Malley and the Wisconsin Counties Association, because this governor, and I believe this legislature, is ready to, they've had enough with this Trump driving in the state of Wisconsin. I quite frankly don't like
it. I don't either.
So I would like to see you continue to do your work and move this forward. I think it's very good. I compliment.
Well, actually, it's the drug court during the OWI team that deserves the. I'm just an observer of this. So,
has the legislative committee had their meeting?
No, their meeting's part of the next.
No. Today, I thought it was today. Okay. Too bad. Go ahead, John.
Stuff works. Drug court works, OWI court works. his third offense felony is not going to work. All we're going to do is fill up our jail. It's an unfunded state mandate.
Yes, so it's exactly what it is. Unfunded state mandate.
So the state doesn't pay for their inmates.
Nope.
People aren't going to prison. They're going to jail.
Right.
And it doesn't work.
Yes, and it does not work. And we've got a couple hundred years of experience to prove it doesn't.
And it's going to cost us hundreds of thousands.
We're slow learners sometimes.
We have to build a third edition in the jail. $30 million more. Where is he worth?
Well, speaking of jail.
And the socialists, too.
Speaking of jail, the next chart here shows for the 122 graduates, they would have spent 7,301 days in jail. What they actually spent in jail was 164 days, and these 164 days come in way of a sanction that they received. Sometimes it's a night in jail, sometimes it's 2 days in jail, sometimes it's a weekend in jail. The OWI court team is pretty careful to help people serve their sanction in a way that makes it possible for them to keep their job. So sometimes it's you go in Friday night and you get out Saturday morning, or you go in Friday night, you get out Sunday morning. But that's the 164 days while they're in. Now, this does not count. Every repeat offender in the state of Wisconsin is required to spend 2 days in jail. That's a state mandate. There's no way around that. A judge can't go around it. No one can go around that. They spend 2 days in jail. Those 2 days are not counted on this chart, because while they're serving those 2 days, those are things that have to be taken care of before they become eligible for the OWI treatment court. So those 2 days are not counted on this chart. What they saved then was 6,989 days, and you know, I know all of you are aware of this, but most of the public is not aware of this, at just how fast the money adds up for a day in jail. Those 122 people saved $500,000 to La Crosse County.
Thanks, Bill. How did you get the
$500,000? I mean, I'm just curious. I just
$72 a day.
Okay, $72 a day.
Right.
Multiplied by 100 and...
Well, multiplied by 7,301 days.
Okay, and how did you get the $72 a day?
That come from the sheriff the sheriff, I guess.
Okay, thank you.
We just call up and ask. It used to be $55 a day. And to tell you the truth, La Crosse is not the only program that I evaluate for. I do about five or six programs throughout the country. La Crosse is the cheapest for a day in jail, is the cheapest. For example, Wabasha County for a day in jail is $85 a day. So they save a lot more money. Here's the total cost, or actually it's a partial cost of the program. I didn't add in everything that obviously we could have added in. These are just the main tangible things that anybody would look at when it comes to the cost of the program. You got about $12,000 in jail costs. That's with the program. You got about $300,000 in personnel costs. That's, you know, with the program for 2 years. You got about $14,000 for community service. That's on the benefits side. And you got $500,000 in jail avoidance savings. Total cost is $318,000. Total savings is $517,000. So a net benefit of about $100,000 a year. Well, that's over the 2 years. All of these are the two-year operating, 2006 to 2008. So they're two-year figures. If you just to show you here, if you look at the $13,820, that's community service, and it's $6,900 a year is what they do. You know, it's you get caught up in the numbers and the charts, and of course that's what I'm hired to do. It's an outcome evaluation. What you people don't see is the process evaluation, which I also do for the OWI treatment court team, which shows them where they're, you know, deviating from the guidelines and how to get back in and where they can improve things to make the program operate more effectively and efficiently. But I also do exit interviews of people who've graduated from the program, people who have dropped out of the program voluntarily, or people who have been kicked out of the program, to try and find out what's working and what's not for people. And occasionally I get caught up in the numbers too, because, you know, that's my game and that's what I do. A few months ago when I was putting this report together, I was out snow bodyboarding with my 12-year-old son, and we were climbing up the huge hill that we come down, and it takes quite a while to get to the top, and usually I have to stop and catch my breath. He laughs at that, but I do have to stop and catch my breath. And one of the times I stopped to catch my breath, I was thinking, you know, geez, I got to get back and I got to get another chart done. I got to get that report done, and I got to do this. And you know, then, you know, next week I'm off, and I got to be down in Florida for another team. And so I'm going to be gone for those 3 days, and I got to figure out somebody to take over at the university for me, and I got to cover that. And I'm sitting there, and it's a beautiful day. It's perfectly blue sky, and there's just a little bit of snow falling out of the trees that had come from the night before snowfall. And I'm sitting there going, you know, here I am. How much time of my life do I spend thinking about the future? And it seems like most of my day is not thought about what's happening right now. I spend thinking about what I have to do next. As a matter of fact, I just caught myself thinking about, right after I leave here, I got to go to a school board meeting. And so my mind is already ahead of me, and I lose track of the here and the now. But I'll tell you, those interviews that I do are the most uplifting experience that you can have. This chart is really just a few of the things that people have told me as they're leaving the program. And now I'm a federal evaluator. I give them a confidentiality statement that actually I'm covered by what's called Federal Rule Number 42, and that says that if I tell anybody anything they tell me, I get fined $5,000 and 5 years in a federal penitentiary. That's to maintain the separation between what I'm asking them to tell me and the OWI treatment court team. And that separation is an ethical separation. I cannot come back and tell them, you know, here's how so-and-so told me that he tried to beat the test. So I can't do that. But I do get those reports. I get the reports of how people are trying to beat the test. I get the reports of how people are trying to scam the court program. And while I can't go back and tell them personally, so-and-so tell me this, at the meetings I do get to say, here's one way that people have found to scam the system. And the team can make the correction, and they do make the corrections, and they make the corrections almost immediately. And that's one thing. If you get all these people together, if you get the prosecutor's office and the defense attorneys and the probation people and the police and the caseworkers and the social workers and the treatment people and the judge sitting at one table, boom, the change could be made right then. So that nobody will be able to do that again, not even the next day in the program. But these stories, you know, the one that really hit me the hardest is the third up from the bottom. This is a 54-year-old guy who told me that the day before he came for the interview, it was his son's birthday. And so he had spent the day with his son doing things, and then they had a birthday party. His first birthday party the dad has ever been to. Every other birthday, he's been drunk. And now they spend time together. He, one of the other ones there where they found out that their kids actually loved them, and they didn't know that. They were drunk. These are the kinds of things that keep people from going back. These are the kinds of things that no jail program and most treatment programs can't do, because they don't afford the opportunity for people to make this happen. And part of the requirement of the OWI treatment court is that they have these kinds of support meetings, and they have to report how many they've had. And family is one of the most effective ways that they use to make these support groups that they're required to do, in addition to their treatment requirements. And the last one, of course, almost every single one of them says the same thing, that without this program, they're quite sure. They've been to jail before, and they know as soon as they get out of jail, they go back and they get drunk and they drive. And that's the way it works. And one that's not up there was one I just had a couple of days ago, where his son was killed in a work-related accident. And without this program, he probably would have killed himself, because he would have been drunk, and there's no way he would have been able to handle the grief that he felt. So he credits the program with actually saving his life. Those can't add up in dollars and cents. There's no figure to put on those. And, it's really heartwarming to talk to these people as they're about ready to leave. And one of the ones up there and there, they didn't know how serious a problem they had until this program. And sometimes, they come in with complete denial. They don't have a problem. It's just, the cops riding me again, the cops, they picking on me, and I don't have a problem. And really, this program and the drug court program operates on what's called the brain injury definition of addiction. It's slightly different than most people's understanding of what we call the disease model. The brain injury definition of addiction says that over time, the pleasure centers, the 13 pleasure centers in the brain, over time release dopamine, which triggers our feelings of happiness. Over time, these pleasure centers, this transmitter and receptor, become damaged. And they become damaged to the point where they can't release dopamine for the normal things that make most of us happy. I don't know about you, but when I get a hug from my son, which doesn't happen that much anymore, but when I get a hug from my son, I'm flooded with dopamine, and I feel fantastic. For these people, hugs from their sons don't do that. Your favorite song doesn't mean anything. Sex with the person they love, meaningless. Food, meaningless. The only thing, because of the injury, that can release the dopamine is the alcohol, or the cocaine, or the opiate, or whatever drug they happen to be addicted to. Research tells us that it takes 8 months for that transmitter and receptor to begin the healing process. So the analogy is really very much like having a broken arm. And I'm going to explain why these programs work, why these programs are so effective. If you broke your arm and you went to the doctor, and the doctor said, Mr. Burns, I've set it, and you're going to be fine. What I want you to do is just hold it like this now for 6 weeks. Don't move it or try to use it or anything, and it'll mend just fine. That's our traditional treatment for addiction. That's the traditional treatment. Just don't do it anymore. We'll help you. I'll call you once in a while, the doc might say. I'll call you once in a while, make sure everything is okay. The doc knows that's not going to work. On a voluntary level, you're going to try and use that arm somehow at some time. I know it. So I'm not going to trust you to voluntarily take care of yourself. I'm going to coerce your treatment. I'm going to put you in a cast. Now you can't use it until it's mended.
And then you know what the doctor will do when they cut that cast off? They'll tell you, now don't go right back out and start doing the same things you did before. You're not totally healed yet. So be careful. Well, OWI treatment courts are casts for the offender's brain. We're going to put them in a cast so they can't use it anymore in the way that they've been using it to release the dopamine. And you know, after about 4 months or 6 months, you can really tell the difference, not just in the way that people present themselves, but in terms of their whole attitude and demeanor about life starts to improve. And that's when they start to actually recover. And you can't do that in most voluntary treatment programs. It's very difficult. Some people can. Some people might be able to hold their arm like this for 6 weeks, and it would mend. But we're not going to trust them. We're going to coerce the treatment. And that's what the program does. It coerces the treatment. And the outcome, I think, is that list of intangibles right there. And that's really just a few of them, because I could do hundreds of those. Almost everyone has a story that's heart-wrenching and heart-warming.
Don?
Bill, does it cost the participant anything to be involved in this? You haven't covered that, really.
Well, yeah, it costs them. You know, I think Jane can answer the cost more. I mean, what's the if they have a sobrieter, that's like $20 a day or something. I don't know.
For any time they're on electronic monitoring, it's $10 a day. So forever, whatever part of their sentence they have to spend on electronic monitoring, it's $10 a day. And if they have an alcohol testing piece of equipment in their home only, it's $5 a day. And then we also have something called the SCRAM, which costs them $15 a day. So we have different levels of payment depending on what the service is.
And none of those benefits to the county, none of those fees were included in the cost-benefit chart before. Like I say, it's just the hardcore things that were included in that, not the other things that could have been included. And just to give you an example, one of the things that's not included on the cost side is the cost for the drug tests that they have to do, the breathalyzers and the urinalysis. Those are costs too. They're relatively minimal, but they're still costs.
Any other questions, Jill?
I just want to make a statement about that was there was a question earlier about why other people aren't doing this, and I think that an attempt has been made by La Crosse County to spread information. I know that Jane has been on committees talking to legislators about this. I know that my husband Judge Levine has worked on it too, but it hasn't spread as quickly as I think it should have. And, you know, could be ego, could be money. I think that what we have here, it just highlights that what we have here is such an incredible situation, an incredible program, that we had a justice sanctions coordinator who was committed to this and worked for over a decade to getting where we are now. We had judges, three who are retired now, who put time and effort and training into and will into bringing everybody to the table and trying this better, different way of dealing with people with addictions. And in fact, I was invited to a drug court graduation this week, and retired Judge Perlich was there. Even though he's been out of it, he had to come back to see this woman graduate. That was something that he was thrilled to be there to see that. He's still excited by this work. And it's still a lot of work. I mean, for the judges and the public defenders, the district attorneys, the people on Jane's staff, our clinical services people, the people that work on this, this is work that's above and beyond, but it shows better results, and it is changing lives. And it doesn't magically happen, but good work has been done here, and we're continuing to try to, I shouldn't say we, people in La Crosse County are continuing to try to spread this good work to the rest of the state.
That's a great point, Jill. I think you're absolutely right. One of the reasons that it isn't more widespread is because it does take a lot of work. It's not an easy thing for a team to come together and to learn to work together. We're used to an adversarial system when it comes to criminal justice, and for people to come together and all of a sudden start to cooperating, that doesn't happen without a lot of training. And that training is not an easy thing to do. And your other point I thought was very good too. La Crosse is actually not just a model for the state of Wisconsin. It's a model really for the region and the nation in terms of how to do these alternative programs for people with addiction problems.
Along those same lines, I just asked Mr. Sobranek if he would be willing to serve on a committee that Judge Bjerke is putting together for a veterans court. So we have a lot of people that are trying a lot of different things in our community.
And, that's right.
You know, reflects well upon us. Other questions or comments for Bill? Bill, thank you very much. Your enthusiasm and passion for this is well noted. And Jane, likewise, thank you for all of your efforts. Next is the chair's report. I just have a couple bullet points to hit here real quick. On your desk was the thing from State Bank about the economic indicators event that is going to be coming up on Wednesday, April 1st, if you're interested in that. It tells you the details there. If you want to register, you can contact the chair's office. We can take care of that for you also. Park Plaza, Mr. O'Malley and I met with Phil Addis, who is Jay Heschler's attorney, last week to talk about, and Bill too, I'm sorry, Bill, to talk about where things stand. And Mr. Heschler is in Costa Rica till the end of the month, I think. So we won't really hear anything back from him probably till sometime in April. But as soon as we do, we'll keep you posted. Check the board for correspondence. There is a thank you card from Bridget Flood up there. Also, you'll see the county board picture. If you're interested in buying one of those, they're $10. Talk to the clerk's office about that. And the last thing is I was contacted by Charlie Handy today. The State Department of Revenue is looking into the concept of having countywide assessing on a statewide basis or perhaps pilot projects. They are possibly going to be sending a delegation to La Crosse to talk about that concept sometime either later this month or in the not-too-distant future. And when and if that happens, I will let board members know about that. There are a lot of pros to that. There are some cons to it also. If it does become an issue, I think this board would be well-served to be very familiar with all the details of how that works. So I'll keep you posted on that. I just heard from Charlie on that today. That's it under my report. Future agenda items, anybody have anything? Jerry Sobranek?
Thank you. It's not for future agendas, but it's just a comment I'd like to make on the energy. On March 24th, there's a workshop at the La Crosse Center. It's for elected officials, county administrators, supervisors, municipal officials, school board members. Attended this workshop is sponsored by your Southwest International Trade and Business Economic Development Council, better known as ZIPBEC. This one-day workshop has been designed to meet the needs of local elected officials. Join other elected officials for a day of learning and exchanging ideas that may have a profound effect on your approach to the energy-related decisions for which we are responsible. There's going to be exhibits, displays. Your EdPEC will have a booth there also. And some of the members that are attending are the big ones, XL Energy Alliance, American Transmission, etc. They'll be presenting programs. Some of the programs would be like electricity resources for 2009, an overview of the current state of electric generation, going green with renewable energy resources, technologies, and use now those in the horizons. There is lunch. The role of the elected officials will have an energy issues during lunch. There will be breaks with refreshments, and this goes from 8:30 a.m. on Tuesday the 24th until 4:30. Anybody needing the cost of the workshop is $35, which includes a continental breakfast, refreshment breaks, lunch, and instructional materials. Anybody needing copies to get registered for this should see Arlene. She will take care of you. Thank you.
And I have the brochures up here. Anybody who's interested, come and grab one. I still have some more of these Southwest Wisconsin bicycling maps up here also. I feel like a tourist center up here. Any other, Marilyn? No, we are still working on that. Have you guys heard anything? Hopefully at county board next week we'll have some more details for you on that. He's been talking about it, but I don't think that he ever actually settled on a date. So. Other questions or comments? Jeff Schrader?
I'm happy to announce that I'm grandpa again for the sixth time.
Anybody else? Okay, don't forget the evaluations for Steve O'Malley. If you have a chance, fill it out, get it up to me. Jim Burns?
My wife and I, we haven't had our baby yet. She was due last Wednesday, so maybe this week.
Good luck. We'll clap then. Motion to adjourn by Jerry Sobranek, second by Arlene Benrood. All in favor say aye. Opposed no. Carried unanimously.